Well, I hope to get some light here for no other reason than that I can read my notes. Just a few words of introduction, and I'd like to make this kind of informal discussion and have the chance to hear your ideas. When I was first asked to give a paper on church architecture, I kind of panicked. This wasn't more than a few weeks ago, and as many architects are these days, I've been very busy at work with a number of projects, and also very busy at home working on my own house. And my wife / project manager says I'm a few years behind on that anyway. So in addition to all that, I have two sons on two different Little League teams. So I had a lot of time, and it took me a couple of days to decide whether or not to try to put something together. And one of the reasons I decided to is that for years I've been thinking about writing a letter to some general authority in Utah concerning my thoughts on church architecture. I feel very passionate about architecture, as you can imagine, and have formulated in many ways different things I might say, but have made excuses to myself or found other things to do rather than writing that letter. And what I realized is that this would give me the chance to get down on paper some of the thoughts that I had about church architecture, and maybe, if nothing else, this discussion will turn to this letter that I've wanted to write. When I talk about architecture, church architecture, amongst my friends in the church, I don't think they understand how strongly I feel about it, and I often get sort of a shrug of the shoulders or a little laugh when I complain about one building or another. I guess one of the comparisons I was trying to relate to my parents is that it, for as strongly as many people felt about Proposition 22 on one side or the other, I have always felt just as passionate about church architecture and concerned about the direction of the church architecture program. Having said that, I wanted to talk for just a second about the title of my talk. When I told my dad what it was, he, in his advanced age, is not as rebellious as he used to be, and he wanted me to say something to the effect, or something like, the San Diego Temple is ugly, and other irreverent thoughts on Mormon architecture. And the reason I didn't take that suggestion is that I felt that it would immediately be apologizing for making a comment on the aesthetic form of one of our buildings. And although this title is somewhat tongue-in-cheek, one of the points that I would like to make is that we need to be able to separate the sacred nature of what happens inside the temple from the form and aesthetics, physical appearance of the temples, and that we should be able to have an open discussion about what temples look like, as well as other Mormon buildings look like, without feeling that we're being irreverent. Let's see. I will discuss some other LDS building types, but one of the reasons that I chose to focus on temples is because of their importance within our culture. And we just don't see meeting houses as the beacons to the world that we see our temples as being. The church buys prominent plots of land for its temples and spends considerable amount of energy publicizing them and building them, of course. In his book, Houses of God, Religion, and Architecture in the United States, Peter Williams says that temples are the most dramatic and unique aspect of the world's environment. The architecture of these temples has been intended to convey a sense of imposing presence to Mormons and non-Mormons alike. Early Mormon temples were deliberately sited at high places, symbolizing Mormon success in dominating a hostile natural environment through tenacity, organization, and irrigation, as well as defying the broader society that attempted to bring the Mormons into conformity with its own norms. So I would like to talk for a second about the idea of beauty and whether or not this is purely a subjective matter, or whether it is something that's even open for debate. Is it worth my saying that the San Diego temple is ugly if beauty is relative and only in the eye of the beholder? Well, I believe that there is some objectivity in the judgment of beauty, and there are a lot of reasons for that. One is that we all have common experiences from which to judge things, and maybe one way to explain that is to think about how we look at human beings. We've all seen enough human beings and human bodies to know when one is well proportioned or not. We might have slight differences of opinion in what is an ideal body, but when we know when we look at Shaquille O'Neal that he's tall and that Danny DeVito's kind of short and stout, and there's not much of an argument about that. I remember when a professor of mine at UCLA commented that a building that I liked on campus was out of scale and short and fat. I was surprised and a little bit bewildered because I didn't understand the concept. I hadn't looked at enough buildings to know why he felt that way. And I think that now I have looked at enough buildings to be at them on their scale and proportion, and I believe that everyone can have the same experience that they have in judging the human body or any other form if they study these things out enough. I also don't want to get too much into the science of the way that we visualize things, but it's clear that architects and others have thought interesting things about how we see things, especially three-dimensional objects. And for example, the Greeks knew this well, and many of the elements in their buildings were put there not for decorative purposes, but to help the eye see the building in a certain way. Classical columns, for example, have bases and capitals not to be ornate, but to show that the column stops and starts. It's very disconcerting to see a building or a part of a building that doesn't seem to end at the ground, but that you can imagine continuing into the ground. This happens to be a particular problem of many Latter-day temples, and I have a few slides that we can look at to see some of that. If there's a limit to which we can discuss whether something is beautiful or not, I would like to talk about other ways in which we talk about architecture and ways in which architecture can be meaningful. Because even if we don't agree on the beauty of one building or another, I think there are other criteria by which we judge architecture. I have a few quotes that I'd like to share that will help me describe some of these thoughts that I have. One is from Anne of Austria, who instructed her architect in 1635, "The church must be a sumptuous and magnificent sanctuary in order to compensate as much as possible for the extreme vulgarity and poverty of the place where the eternal word chose to be born." clearly, when we contrast our buildings with the idea that Christ Himself was born in the most humble of buildings, it must inspire us to think deeply about their meaning. Walter Gropius, the founder of Bauhaus, said this: "What is architecture? The crystalline expression of man's noblest thoughts, his ardor, his humanity, his faith, his religion. That is what it once was. We walk through our streets and cities and do not howl with shame at such deserts of ugliness. Let us be quite clear. These gray, hollow, spiritless mock-ups in which we live and work and worship, I add, will be shameful evidence for posterity of the spiritual descent into hell of our generation, which forgot that great unique art, architecture. All our works are splinters, structures created by practical requirements and necessity that do not satisfy the longing for a world of beauty built anew from the bottom up, for the rebirth of that spiritual unity which ascended to the miracle of the Gothic cathedrals." Hans Holland, an architect, said this about architecture: "It is a great spiritual order realized through building. Architecture, the idea built into infinite space, manifesting man's spiritual energy and power, the material form and expression of his destiny, of his life. From its origins until today, the essence and meaning of architecture have not changed. To build is a basic human need. It is first manifest not in the putting up of protective roofs, but in the erection of sacred structure, in the indication of focal points of human activity, the beginning of the city. All building is religious. Architecture, the expression of man himself, at once flesh and spirit. Architecture is elemental, sensual, primitive, brute, terrible, mighty, dominating. But it is also the embodiment of the most noble emotions, a sensitive record of the most refined sensations, a materialization of the spiritual." I believe that in its best form, architecture says not only something about the God that we worship, but about ourselves. And I believe that even if we set aside the idea of beauty, there is much to discuss about what our buildings do in terms of relating to others, how we view God, and how we see ourselves. Gilbert Cope said in Christianity and the Visual Arts, "What does matter about religious building is whether it is an intelligible material statement about God and the world, or just an exhibitionist product of architectural expertise. Whether it communicates something of the Christian paradox of human equality within a hierarchical order, or is it merely a museum for the display of ornamental arts and crafts?" I think sometimes we forget how important a role architecture plays in our lives. But for a few hours a week, we spend our lives in buildings. Buildings are our sort of largest form and greatest physical legacy that we leave on the earth. Catherine Slessor, an editor at Architectural Review, said, "Buildings currently constitute the single largest energy-consuming human creation, with the simple consequence that the sustainability of the built environment has a major impact on the global ecosystem. Instead of energy-consuming static environmental receivers, buildings are being recast as energy-generating dynamic environmental controllers." I've seen this certainly happen over the last 10 to 15 years studying architecture. And I'll read a little later a scripture that for me is a call to build architecture that is respectful of the earth, and that, as this woman has suggested, gives back to the earth rather than taking from it. Finally, last thought on the meaning of architecture. In a church that is sometimes very insular, architecture is a great way to share something with those around us who are not of our faith. It is very, in one sense, a very democratic art. It is, at least from the exterior, most buildings are free to all and are a gift, potentially a gift to all. And because of that, I believe it gives us a responsibility to do what we can to really create lasting, beautiful buildings. I'd like to speak for a moment on the practical side of architecture. Architecture is not just an art. It is a science, and it is a practical way to provide shelter. And in a church in which utility and practicality are paramount, I think that often the aesthetics of a building are overlooked for the practical purposes of a building. I wish I had some light up here, but I'll do what I can to read some of these notes. It's interesting how we're often sort of obsessed with size, quantity, and facts. I think that the church missionary program at one point realized the problem with having baptism goals by number. And I think the idea of creating 100 temples in a short period of time, while noble, in one sense, there have been some aesthetic concerns have sort of fallen by the wayside in order to achieve that. It's interesting to me that in most of the discussions I've heard about the new conference center in Utah, they don't there isn't much discussion about what the building looks like, but how big it is, or how many cubic yards of concrete were made to build it, and how heavy and long the King Truss is, the fact that you can fit a 747 within the building. Well, you can fit a 747 in an airport hangar, but that doesn't necessarily make it an appropriate place to worship. Not that the conference center isn't, but I just think that we should focus less on these interesting tidbits of fact and think more about what our buildings look like and how they contribute or don't contribute to the way we worship. Just a brief aside about the profession of architecture. I think outside the world of architecture, architects are all seen as being somewhat the same. In the profession, often there are three types of architects, especially in larger firms that work on bigger projects. There are project architects, project managers, and project designers. Project architects are concerned with the technical aspects of the building, putting it together, keeping it weatherproof, making it constructible. The project managers are concerned with keeping the client happy, making sure the client goals are achieved. And the project designers are concerned with the design of the building, the aesthetics of it. My sense is that in the church's desire to be practical and economical, that the church building department is filled with quite a few project architects and project managers, but is a little short on project designers. Okay. One of the indications to me of architecture that is worth that has meaning is that there is a dialogue about it. And in all of the architectural journals that I skim through between projects or at lunchtime, I have yet to see a church temple in any of them, or any other building for that matter. if the critics aren't talking about it, I think that tells us something. When my mom was down here over Easter break, she offered to do some research for me, so I sent her up to the University Research Library at UCLA and asked her to find any critique of Mormon temples or other Mormon buildings. She spent a day up there and basically found nothing. The one thing that I found on the internet was fairly telling. It was actually an article about a stake center in Northern California. And the person who wrote it was a reporter, not an architectural critic, but he interviewed a lot of people, and I'd like to share some of the things they said about it. The stake president said, 70,000 bricks if you're counting. One woman said, whoa, baby, that's a palace. Where did they get all that money? The manager of the community services district said, some people love it, some hate it. The reporter added, many seem especially put off by the church's sheer massiveness. The community services director added, the people who've commented to me say, wow, it's humongous. One man added, we all agree it looks like a nice Ethan Allen showroom. Suggesting, in other words, a model of production line mediocrity. The rest of this article, by the way, was a very fair and supportive article of the church, but it started with this discussion about the stake center. One man who could see the stake center from his backyard said, would you want that in your backyard? He added with a flair of one-liner comic, it's really ostentatious. One woman said it shows a clear lack of planning on the part of the Mormon church and of the community. They came in bulldozing and knocking down all but a few trees. It bothers me a lot, enough that I'm considering moving. The church's red brick wall suggests some kind of colonial architecture, but then the pyramidal cornices of synthetic plaster topping the brick might suggest an ancient Greek temple without the colonnade. In truth, it's hard to peg. It's funny, I saw a picture of this and I thought it was one of the nicer Mormon buildings I've seen in a long time. Let's see. When the reporter says that when he called the Eureka architect Jack Freeman to ask him what kind of architecture he'd call it, he burst into laughter. I'd call it Mormon architecture, he said. Reminds me of when the San Diego Temple was built. There wasn't much said about that either, but one of the critics said it was an architectural fantasy, and another said that, I don't know if you've seen the temple or not, but it's sitting right next to Highway 5, the Interstate 5. It's just right practically on the freeway. And he said that until he'd seen the building, he didn't realize that the Mormons didn't believe in the separation of church and interstate. I remember asking my professor at UCLA, who's an architectural historian, what he thought about the LA temple. And he said, it's a really nice second-class building. And he said the reason, the thing that makes it so nice are the palm trees. So it's not even a part of the building that makes it what it is, according to him. I remember looking through a guidebook. There's a very extensive guidebook on Los Angeles architecture by David Gebhardt and Robert Winter. And the L.A. Temple, the only commentary on the L.A. Temple is that it is called Cocktail Lounge Modern. This, I'm sure, without the critic having stepped into the celestial room, he really would have been convinced. But anyway, I mentioned earlier that there was a scripture I wanted to share, and that's in DNC 59. And it's interesting that this scripture was received as the saints were preparing to build the temple. And it says in the introduction that Joseph Smith was writing descriptively of the land. So he was, I'm sure, very in tune with the not only the importance of building the temple, but of the gifts that God has given us in this earth. And the scripture says, "Verily I say that inasmuch as ye do this, the fullness of the earth is yours, the beasts of the field, and the fowls of the air, and that which climbeth upon the trees and walketh upon the earth. Yea, and the herb and the good things which come of the earth, whether for food or for raiment, or for houses or for barns or for orchards or for gardens or for vineyards. Yea, all things which come of the earth in the season thereof are made for the benefit and the use of man, both to please the eye and to gladden the heart. Yea, for food and for raiment, for taste and for smell, to strengthen the body and to enliven the soul. And it pleaseth God that he hath given these things unto man, for unto this end were they made to be used with judgment, not to excess, neither extortion." As I said earlier, I see this for me personally as a call to make my architecture an architecture that does not extort the gifts of God in his creation of the earth, but that gives back in some way. It's interesting that in the temple we learn that through the creative process that God went through to create the earth, he did two things. One was to give beauty, but the other was to give variety. And again, back to the discussion of beauty, if there's a limit to which we can discuss whether something's beautiful or whether church temples are beautiful, we can turn to the idea of variety. And there's a sticking point when we get there, as you'll see when we talk about, when I show some of the slides. Okay, I want to try to wrap this up so I give Jim a chance to say it, because I'm very interested in what he has to share with us. I guess the last idea relating to our theology is that we more than any other religion take literally Christ's admonition to be perfect, and I believe that should, of course, filter into all aspects of our lives, including our attempt to create shelter and build buildings of worship. Matthew Arnold, Victorian poet, said this: "What makes us most human is the recognition within ourselves a need, even a virtual addiction, to seek the perfection of life. I begin to perfect life when I want to live by perfecting the exemplars of that life in art and architecture." Okay. Let's turn the slides on there, Dad. That's going to be tough to get it back now. Pressing the green button. Focus. I apologize for these slides. They were taken from a digital file off the internet and then transferred for $7 a pop to a 35 millimeter slide, but I think there's enough there to kind of see the building. This is the San Diego Temple, for those who don't know. I don't think there's time to get into a discussion about why I don't find it attractive, but to add to what the other architectural critics said about it, I kind of see it as kind of a cross between Snow White's Enchanted Castle and Space Mountain. There's just this weird mixture of styles, but let's go forward to the next one, Dan. There are basically, well, focus first, and then you probably just have to lift it up to see what we can. There are two building types or forms of most of the recent temples. This is one of them. This is a Chicago temple. I could have picked several of them, but I picked Chicago because of its great tradition of architecture. I guess I call this one the Shed Inspires version. And anyway, again, it's not enough time to get into a lengthy discussion of it. But one of the biggest problems for me is that the same building is in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And as we, and in other foreign countries, I'll get into more with some of the later slides on why I believe that's inappropriate. Okay, the next one is Palmyra. And this is also one of the other common versions, which is kind of a box and a spire. And there are different variations on it, but they're all pretty much alike. I talked earlier about the idea of buildings not stopping, or of the idea of buildings needing to have some sort of foundation. These buildings, to me, seem to have lost their middle. The steeple, to me, looks as if it's somehow collapsed into the middle of the building. Others might not see it that way, but that's one of the things I see when I see them. Next slide. Have you guys seen this temple? Yeah. It's the reorganized church temple. Can you focus that a little better? This was actually done by my last firm, and it's a very interesting building. I've brought two examples of other types of buildings, and I chose these this because of its connection to us through the reorganized church, but also because it's very different in form and use from the next one that I'll show you. Okay, keep going. Just keep going. That's just another exterior shot. I don't know why this projector goes out of focus every time. The contractors had a real hard time putting that roof on. There wasn't a flat surface to stage their equipment on. Go ahead. That's looking up the interior. Next slide. Yeah. Okay. Next slide. Next slide. Okay, this is a church in Finland by an architect named Juha Laviska. I probably butchered his name. Go ahead. Very different, obviously, in form. A series of planes, not a curved line in sight. Keep going. This is the southeast facade. Keep going. One more. This is a shot of the interior model, and when I did a study of this in school, I created a model and took some pictures, and we'll go through those quickly. Go ahead. There's a site plan. This is north-south with the chapel at the south end of the complex. And side elevation. Keep going. Okay, this is to show what the sun does in this part of the world. At the summer solstice, so June 21st at noon, that's as high as the sun gets in the sky. At the equinoxes, it's only 27 degrees off the Earth's surface. And at the winter solstice, only 3.5. The average azimuth angle is about 17 degrees, so it's inconsistent, even though the height changes throughout the year. The azimuth angle in the morning is the same. Here's a plan of the chapel. The altar's up above. You see on the right-hand side there are a series of south-facing windows and a series of north-south running baffles. This I found out in studying this building that the service was held from 10 to noon on Sunday mornings. This is what happens with the light at 10, 11, and noon, when the sun rays actually burst through these openings. Okay, next slide. This is a picture of the model that I made looking toward the altar. This is 9 o'clock in the morning, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. You can see the subtle changes in light and shadow. Go ahead. And at the highlight of the service at noon, where the light actually breaks through and you see the direct beams of light in the chapel. If you go, keep going. This is at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. You can see the subtlety is all lost. 3 o'clock. It's all designed around this. I'm not sure which one this is. Keep going. Okay, this shows, the next three slides just show the building at the same time at the equinox, and the two solstices. And you can see the light doesn't change much. You probably can't see it because we're going through it so quickly, but despite the fact that the sun movement is so different in these times of the year, the effect is the same in the church. One more. Keep one more again. This is what would happen if you took the building and put it in Brazil or someplace else. It's turning it so that it's not sighted the way it was designed to be. Okay, I don't know if that's it or not. Try one more. That's it. Okay. Let's see. Well, I'll wrap this up without getting into the lengthy conclusion, but I think that I guess what I challenge you, especially those of you who are not as educated in architecture as others, to really look and think about architecture and think about its meaning. I know that architecture is so multi-layered and has so many meanings that it can really enrich our lives. And I will turn the time over to Jim. I hope I haven't taken too much of your time, Jim.
Are you leaving me? Can you hear? Everybody here in the back? I can probably project my voice. I do that enough. I'm a famous actor in the movies. You probably don't recognize me. I'm an architect, and I have always loved architecture, like Rob, and it's been a passion of mine, just like the gospel. I actually teach architecture at USC and teach architecture based on gospel principles. The students don't know that, so I just kind of secretly slide it in all the time. But I don't know how I'm supposed to approach this, whether I'm supposed to support Rob or just forget it and try to really be aggravated and, and talk about the complementary aspects of the church architecture, which I find extremely difficult. He's a lot better versed on the architecture of the church than I am, because I have to confess that I pretty much gave up on trying to help the church because I tried on a number of occasions, and it was really a study in futility. So I didn't want to destroy my testimony, so I kept going on and trying to do the work I did and just avoided doing things with the church. I probably should touch on some of the things that I did with Salt Lake City. I should go way, way back to where I was a student in architecture, and I approached the president of the church at the time, David O. McKay, who, you know, that really puts me in a difficult state here because everyone now knows how old I was. But President McKay, who is a wonderful, wonderful person, but I had written a letter because the church was planning to do the new church office building and the church headquarters. And as a student, I was just graduating. I was just doing my thesis, and I had written a letter telling them that I didn't think that the church office building was a good building, nor was it a good symbol of the church, because I said that I thought that the real significance of the church was the spiritual aspect, not the temporal. And I said, now you're making the temporal aspects of the church more important. Because in Salt Lake City, for a long period of time, you weren't supposed to build a building higher than the spires on the temple, which was really a strange kind of code. Even Salt Lake and the state of Utah conformed to that code. And yet, then later people, I think the Copper building, who's Kennecott Copper, built their building. And I think the spire still was a little higher than Kennecott Copper's building, which was still, I think, then 20 stories high. But so my written letter to the church was that I felt like that this was really kind of a dastardly deed for the church. And I said, as you drive down State Street, you're really just going to see the church headquarters, which I don't think would be as significant as the temple. I wrote the letters and then called and asked if anyone had read my letter, and nothing ever happened, and no one responded. And so finally I got a very strange phone call from the office of Hugh B. Brown, and they said, Brother Brown has been given your letter, and he's been asked to talk to you, which I thought was really terrific, because I thought that's wonderful. So I don't like the church headquarters building, and I said, yes. That's true. And he said, well, why don't you tell me why you don't like it? And so I described, wasn't even the architecture. I was basically talking about planning, city planning and urban problems and how the building would fit as a community building and its relationship to the church and what I've already told you. So he said, Brother Tyler, you're like the flea on the elephant's foot. I always remember the statement because that's what he said to me. He says, you don't know why the elephant has all those wrinkles. And I still, you know, I like to use that term periodically with my students because they don't know how old I am either. But anyway, he said that, and with that statement, I was a little put off because I thought, I don't think he understands what I'm talking about. So he said, what would you recommend that we do? I said, I think that you could probably lay this down in a U-shaped building and have a garden in the middle and the U-shape with the bottom of the U facing east, that you could face westerly and see the temple, so that the garden and the buildings all had orientation that they could look toward the temple. And I said you could probably do it in about a 4 or 5 story office building and not do a 20. At the time, it was a 35-story building. And so President Brown says, why don't you do some drawings and recommend that, and I'll see that the church could look at them. I told him this because I thought that it was a way that the building in and of itself could still have the same amount of square footage, but would be more of a horizontal building than a vertical building. I think the church liked the idea of the symbol of the church and the strength of the church being in this vertical building. Anyway, it was a strange kind of situation because I graduated from the University of Utah and then had an opportunity to move to California. So I moved to California. I never did the sketches. I never did do anything related to that. I wrote a letter thanking President Brown, but I noticed that later that the building had gone from 35 stories to 28. I think it's 28 now. But anyway, that was my clash with the church. But after that, I was able to just kind of go on and enjoy architecture the way I had always enjoyed it. And I was asked from time to time to do church building. So I had done some remodeling of different churches, the Santa Monica Ward, the First Ward. And then later, I was asked, because I had done some work with the Stake Center, the Santa Monica Stake Center, they said, we'd like you to do a building. And they said, we'd like to remodel the Mar Vista Ward. The Mar Vista Ward was a very nice kind of Spanish style. Actually, it wasn't. You know, people say Spanish style, but the truth of the matter was that it wasn't a good Spanish style. But anyway, I had worked on some designs for that. So I decided that I would really... Actually, I recommend the church that they not remodel the building, that they tear it down, because by code, it was way out of code, and the cost of construction for renovation and remodeling would be tremendously high. So I actually recommend that they tear the building down, and they decided that they would do that. So they said, would you come up with a design for the new chapel? So I actually designed a building not too different from the one that Rob just showed on the screen in Finland. Is it Finland? Yeah. It was a series of planes, and it had light, natural light that would come in. But because Mar Vista Ward is on Sentinel, and it was a hill, as you go up the hill from Venice Boulevard, I thought that I would terrace the building so that at the highest part of the site would be the highest part of the building. And it was actually terraced in three steps, so that it was to convey the terrestrial, celestial, and the celestial kingdom. And I worked hours and hours and hours on this thing. And I sent it to Salt Lake, and they said that it was probably a little too contemporary for them. And they asked if I would adjust the design, which I started to back off, and I did two or three other schemes. But I kept going back to this idea, because my thought was that the expression of the building should... And it's very difficult for me to even talk about things like this, because the to me, architecture is very, very deep, and it's difficult to comprehend what I would even get into, and I don't even have the time. But historically, architecture has been based on an idea. Every culture was based on an idea. Once the culture died, the idea died. So the basic idea of, let's say, the Egyptians was life eternal. I mean, the pyramids, the Temple of Karnak, all of these buildings were done with this kind of endless search for the eternities and life after death. The artwork, everything was done based on this idea. But later the culture all died, the idea died, and when people say, well, we're trying to revive Egyptian architecture and what that related to those people, and I almost get tears in my eyes, because I think there's no way you even understand what those people were doing. Spiritually, you have no idea of what they were doing. If you talk about Gothic architecture, I could go through all architecture, but Gothic architecture was really an architecture that freed up everything. Intellectually, structurally, materials, spiritually, it was really the light of Christ. And the light that came into the building, the triforium galleries, the windows, the rose windows, all of those things amplified this idea that there was going to be new light and knowledge that would be revealed to everyone. It was an educational building. It taught people about Christianity. The rose window was symbolic of the Virgin Mary. And the building itself, the actual Gothic cathedral, was really the body of Christ. Not the body of God, but the body of Christ, which was teaching these people about what religion was really all about and what their lives should be. So, for me, there's I would probably get into a big discussion on subjectivism and objectivism, because I try to continue to teach students that there is no such thing as subjectivism in architecture. which would, a lot of people would say, what about ornament? What about all of these other things? But to me, intellectually, you are always very objective about how you make decisions about architecture. And that is that everything, absolutely everything, has a reason for it. That's why it's objective. Now, how you as an architect interpret what that may be to give messages to become more subjective, then I would say that if you have subjectivism in architecture, it's based on objectivism. You can have subjective architecture, but it's based on the objective facts. God allows us as human beings to be godlike every day of our life, the way we treat people, the way we act, whatever. That's the purpose of why we were sent here. So you, in a very, very small way, and I know Rob feels this, when you design a building, you're actually taking on that godlike quality because you are the only one that can interpret what the nature and the idea of that building is. And so when I see buildings like the church does, it's hard for me to even look at them because all of my architecture has been based on the ontological character of buildings. That is, what's the nature of a building? And I have to try to teach the students all the time, you have to pull out the nature or the spirit of that building because a building is not unlike you. There are physical aspects to you, but what's the spiritual side? And they don't know what to say because it's very difficult at young ages to understand what that means. But the spirit of the architecture is how is it built? What are the materials? How do you put all that together and how do you articulate that so that there's some expression? My problems with the temples and that is I see no ontological character to them. I don't know how they're built. I mean, you go in and it's just a lot of plaster and stucco and materials that are just applied over. They're not applied within. There is no personality and character to it because if we're on earth to learn, and this is an educational process, when you walk through a building, regardless of what it is, it could be an outhouse, you should know and understand. I mean, a good outhouse could be as good a piece of architecture as a cathedral, only because the nature and the character of that is expressed in an honest way. So I had difficulty when I was doing this ward building because when you see the Mar Vista ward now, you don't even see that building. The church insisted that that we do a building that they had recommended, so they sent us photographs of other buildings that we did. And after about 6 or 8 schemes trying to convince them, I just sensed that it was going to get nowhere. So I decided maybe it was just better not to do that. And if I'm in charge of my destiny, I usually don't design things that I don't spiritually feel right about. So I had some people in my office who had done tract housing and had done little simple stucco arched, kind of phony arched structural ideas. And I said, do you guys want to design this building? So they said, we'll do it. They said, you should really do this for the church. You shouldn't give up on them or whatever. And so we kept the job, did the building, and it was really a potluck party. It was really my office and me just kind of recommending ideas and so on. But I can't credit for the building because I really didn't design it. It was designed primarily by my staff and people who said, we can do it. We can do it the way the church really wants it done. The sad part was what I really thought could have been a good piece of architecture they didn't want to do. And, I don't understand how they function. I don't really communicate a lot with them. I have good friends that work there, and they work from 8 to 5, and they have a nice job, and the church takes care of them. But I don't think that there's any suffering, about how things are done like you are when you're practicing on your own. I think the church should really allow architects outside the office of the church architecture department to design their buildings. I don't think that that's ever going to happen. I think if the architecture is going to become meaningful to Latter-day Saints and really do good architecture, it would almost have to be done by a private architectural firm. But I think they should also understand what the spiritual qualities of Mormonism are all about. I don't know how they do that. I know that the church hired outside architects to do the new conference center, but I don't think that I don't know how much they really knew about the church, you know. But anyway, yes. Yeah, I think most of some of the detailing and the interiors were done by an outside firm. I don't know that the exterior was done primarily by it. I think my understanding is, actually, I'm not overly critical. You said that there are not too many publications. I've actually read different architectural magazines, Architectural Review and some European magazines, that say that there's a certain kind of quality about Mormon churches that express the ornamentation of architecture in a way that we think should come back more to modern architecture rather than these simple plain forms. And I mean, I have an argument with that, but I have heard them comment on that, saying that they felt like that there's a certain quality of ornamentation to it. But the interesting thing is that the interiors are actually quite nice. The husband and wife team that were outside the church that designed that really did a qualitative job. There's a lot of nice Frank Lloyd Wright furniture in there, and so it was actually quite well done. I was kind of pleased with that part only, but the rest. Oh, you can kick me out anytime.
Just a comment about the San Diego Temple. A friend of mine is Bruce Finlayson, who works for Temple Interiors. Just before the building was dedicated, he was doing some of his finish work and asked me to come down and help him a little bit, and that way I got to go stand the stern of the building. Yes, the principal architect was a Mormon, who also, and his name is slipping my mind, but he did a superb building on Trojan Street in San Diego. Very LDS building. Anyway, but the interiors were done by some non-Mormons. However, going through that building, my biggest grumble was the endowment rooms are the pokiest little rooms in the building and have no sense of real place or purpose. And instead of a flow into the celestial room, you go down little halls. I was under,
yeah.
I understood that part of the problem there was fitting in all the different pieces. However, the comment I wanted to make was after going through this building and being, as I always am, never without opinion, and disliking it intensely, and having all sorts of rude things to say about it, I stood in the parking lot as we came on the light, just adjacent to it, and there were these girls, really trashy girls, Pierce, Catholic, and they were looking at it, smoking, carrying on. And then one of the little girls happened to say, you know, they were teenagers, early 20s, you know, I don't believe in anything. I don't believe in God. But that's the prettiest church I ever saw in my life, and it almost makes me want to believe in God. And I thought, well. So I backed off a little bit. The next thing that it did was the church wanted an instant landmark. They got it.
Yeah.
That's, you know, I think it achieved those goals. Whether it was worth the money that they spent, which has always been downgraded. There
was a lot of money, a lot of
extravagance
on
a building, but it was a good try. But for me, it still is disappointing.
But
I thought that was an interesting little lesson.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Okay, thank you all very much. Thank you, Jim.